Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to a special one-off podcast where we're going to talk about a newish feature series we've been running on Eurogamer, in which we're taking some big topics, big pieces, and really diving into them, really taking our time to do it right. I'm Bertie, an associate editor at Eurogamer, and today I'm joined by Ed Nightingale, who's deputy news editor, to talk about this. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Bertie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. So I'm talking to Ed because Ed wrote the first of these on character creators, and I have just written the second of these on video game maps, well, maps in general. And we wanted to talk about, well, the piece itself and then the process of doing it, what it's like, and what we hope maybe it means to you to read them. So I'm going to kick off just by giving people an overview of the piece I've written about maps.
And I'm excited about this because I haven't heard this yet. So I want to know what you've been up to.
So do I. So I have always, like many people, I'm sure, been drawn to maps. I can barely walk past one without having my head turned and looking at it and kind of being pulled into it. And I've always wondered a bit about why that is. You know, it happened to me notably with fantasy books that I'm sure lots of people read, you know, the most famous being The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. But beyond that, almost every fantasy book seems to come with some kind of map at the beginning. And then that extended into video games and their maps. And you can think right back through the lineage of many famous fantasy role-playing series, Final Fantasy actually being a huge one. And they have come with some incredible maps for as long as I can remember. And thinking about maps there, forward now and backwards to Dungeons and Dragons and the importance maps have played there and continue to play there, and thinking about all of this, even games that have maps that aren't, you know, that aren't fantasy shooters, things like this, thinking about all of this and thinking, what is it about maps? Why are we so drawn to them, and has our relationship to maps changed over the years? Has it gotten, we use maps in very different ways these days. You know, we look at maps on our phones a lot, and that's is a massive change that has just happened, and we're okay with because we're a part of this change. But how has that changed our relationship with maps? Games, technologically speaking, their capabilities have changed massively over the years. So has that affected our relationship to maps? So I wanted to investigate all of this big topic, a seemingly small topic, but it's a big,
it's huge thing. There are so many questions. I mean, even just there are so many questions, and like I've got questions I'm like, oh, I want to know if you've answered that.
You know, well, fire away. What do you want to know?
Well, I mean, it's interesting you talk about our relationship with maps, because I feel like, do we now rely on maps more than we used to back in previous days? You know, I think now we tend to have a mini map in the corner, and you're sort of constantly checking where you're going in a game because it's so much more complex.
Yeah,
you know, the topography is more complex, and you need that guidance more than you would have done previously.
Absolutely. So this is a huge part of it, and it mirrors the real world a bit, I think, probably in more ways than we realize. As once upon a time, maps came in boxes. You know, we'd buy a big game box and there'd be a map in there and a manual, and this was great for all sorts of reasons. You know, we could look at the map before we played the game and sort of imagine what might happen in the game, but we could also look at the map in a sense of it teasing a larger world to us, which the game itself wasn't probably capable of drawing or rendering. Which of course is different these days. We don't get maps in boxes, partly because we don't have boxes, but also because the maps that we do get in boxes are not the same. They're sort of decorative accompaniments. We don't actually need them. Games have their own maps in them that we call upon to navigate these, you know, much more intricate and kind of detailed worlds, which are in some cases 3D rendered before us. We don't need a map to sort of fill in the imaginative blank, as it were, and kind of make us think of it. We were talking a bit before about Final Fantasy worlds, and the original Final Fantasy worlds came with these large world maps in their boxes that you could fold out and be like, oh Christ, you know, that looks incredible. But now they don't. And it's thinking as that's progressed, and then we've gained things like mini maps and even like little dot, dot, dot kind of wayfinding routes. I'm thinking of The Witcher particularly. I'm sure games did this before The Witcher, but The Witcher 3 is the one that really comes to my mind, is sort of walks you through the world, which is enormously useful, but it's led to a kind of feeling that a map has a function first and foremost. It's not, I remember, for instance, one of the game maps I particularly remember, and I'll test this theory on you in a second, is the Dark Age of Camelot map. Because I spent a lot of time in that world, you know, one of the first open worlds, I suppose, in games, trying to find my way around. And this, they only had this paper map. I'm pretty sure it didn't have an in-game world map. And so I was using this paper map to kind of navigate the world. And it was hilariously simple, in a sense. I found out while writing this piece that it was actually made with one of these online kind of map maker tools. No one had actually drawn it. They hadn't hired someone.
Oh, wow.
They just sort of skipped that part. And also because the game was separated into three realms. So you played in one of the three realms, and then eventually you sort of battled the other people. You could see on this map the other two realms, and it always led me to thinking, a bit like I did when I was at school and I would see maps of Europe and stuff like that, thinking, oh, I wonder who lives in this big shape over here. And like, I wonder what they're like, and I wonder what it's going to be like when I meet them. So I remember that map partly because I just spent so much time there. Gosh, I can't remember where I was going with this point now. But needless to say that like these things have changed, and as in the real world, actually, maps were once almost works of fiction. People were, you know, imagining the world, really, because we hadn't charted. It's not like we were taking pictures of it from satellites in space. Even a bird's eye view was a strange thing to conceive of once upon a time, because we didn't, you know, not until hot air balloons did we really take to the sky. So thinking of everything from a top-down perspective is kind of weird. Like, would it even help you navigate? Because how could you? You're like, oh, I don't know where to go with this. So in the similar sense, a need to be more accurate came along because we needed to find our way. As people started the age of discovery, and, you know, we were sailing around the world, trade routes became important, coastlines became important, accuracy became really important. As all that happened, fantasy and sort of fiction got elbowed out of map making, and then maps became plans, things that had to be specific. And actually, that pervading thought has continued right up until like the 1990s. I was talking to someone who looks after antiquarian mapping at the British Library, and up until that point, like, maps were considered, you know, this super serious thing. They had to be those things. But in recent years, I think it's as kind of geek culture and stuff has come back in, or has come into the mainstream, the British Library in particular has started collecting fantasy maps, being like, oh, these are important things too. They're playing catch up a bit. And this was all showcased recently by them having a fantasy exhibition which featured maps, as if like a declaration of intent and going, look, fantasy is important to us now. It might have been sort of, we might have looked down our nose at it in the past, but it's important to us now. And I feel games, you know, have done a similar thing. They had these sort of almost fictional, additive, imaginative maps to start with. Then, as worlds needed maps as functional 3D wayfinding points, we were like, right, we just have to have that. And now you come to now, and it looks like games are starting to play with form and function again in the same thing. And a great example of this was given by Tunic's creator, Andrew Shouldis, who, I mean, Tunic does it itself. It kind of it plays around with the map a bit and makes you sort
of... And with the instructions as well, the, you know, the instruction manual. You know, it's sort of playing with that old school vibe.
Yeah, I mean, specifically, he was inspired by reading instruction manuals as a kid and, you know, pulling them out and looking at them and going, "Ooh, what's going to happen in this world?" And the map page was a huge part of this. He'd look at it and he talked about it as being a cornucopia of like kind of stories, in a sense. You see all these little, like, there's a cave over here or there's a little town over here, and you can't help it, your mind goes there, you know, it's pulled into these little places and starts imagining things that are happening there. But he used, so his game does it, but he used this great example, and I love this example for a few reasons. He used Elden Ring as an example because it has it's the first Souls game to have a map, which in and of itself is a remarkable thing. But, and so I think people think, oh, okay, it's got a map, I'll just use it to accurately get me around, just like I do in other games. And I'll come back to that point. It's also gorgeous. To me, it looks a bit like a quilt, but it's got this lovely look. So
it's got that hand-drawn sort of feel to it.
Art is like a key part of it. It's not just like function. Here it is. But he was talking as the map being a bit of an unreliable narrator in a way, because it shows you things from a perspective where things are concealed. Like sometimes you don't know what's under it. And the world it represents is smaller than the actual world in the game, he was saying, and some bits are missing. It's also obscuring things. So it is giving you a map, but it's also playing around a bit with perhaps our current dependency on maps. And it's made it, as a result, a kind of a slight puzzle, something you have to, he likes the word cognitive exercise, cognitive exercise, as maps being like an exciting tool again, something that's noticeable in a game rather than something that's just given and expected, I suppose.
I guess in that game especially, you have to literally piece the map together as you find specific points and then it unlocks that area. So it's not just this massive map that's all in one thing. You know, you have to actually piece it together and understand it. And as you said, bits of it sort of get unlocked over time. And when you find things, they get added to the map. So it's almost like you're creating it yourself, in a sense.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And it's a fascinating example of what people can do when they start looking at maps as an interesting additive element to the game rather than sort of a necessary wayfinding tool. Like, what if we actually bring the map into the gameplay a little bit again? A bit like how maps once were an inherent part of our gameplay when we had to refer to them because we didn't have a choice. That kind of thing. That to me was a sort of fascinating part of the kind of technological advancement of maps in games. I spoke to, there's a guy called Damian Mammoliti. One of the things in this piece is that I spoke to about, I think it was 10 different like people for this. And you only have so much space in a piece. And it's very difficult to, it's very difficult to introduce lots. Well, it's not difficult, but it's not wise to introduce lots of different voices because it starts to confuse the reader a bit. And they're like, God, who's this? What? I don't know. Like, what did they do? So I've got all this stuff that's kind of unused. And I'll ask you about this actually in a second. But Damian Mammoliti was the person who drew the map that came inside the Witcher 3 box, which is this wonderful, to me, it's all like made up of swirls. But it's this wonderful painterly map. I can't remember what I was going to say about him now. An interesting thing he said was that he thinks of maps as caricatures, of like as having to almost like caricature a place to get their most interesting points across. I've remembered it. He is working with a game studio now who who was also, he couldn't tell me who it was, but he said it's like a AAA blockbuster title, and they are specifically trying to marry form and function again. And he talked about this map being a kind of watercolor map, again, one that fills in as you sort of find different areas. So almost like, I guess, you're bringing a painting together. But it suggests perhaps that big game companies are thinking of maps as interesting, interesting things that they can do. So actually, I also spoke to the person who did the Baldur's Gate 3 map, a French man called Marc Moreau. And the map he drew is the map that you get in the collector's edition of Baldur's Gate 3. He thought originally it was going to be in Baldur's Gate 3, and there was maybe a case that it was in the Steam early access version. It was going to kind of, when you walked off, like, say, the end of Act 1, one of those routes, it was going to then tease to you what was coming in Act 2 and 3, okay, which wasn't known really at the time. I mean, it was outlined, but not sort of detailed at the time. And I'm not sure if that made it into the Steam early access build or not, but he wasn't aware that it wasn't going to be in the game until the game. He's not kind of sore about that point, but it's interesting. So many people and trying to find a singular kind of thread through the piece is tricky. I in the end went for a thread that's quite important to me and my gaming tastes, which is the creation of the Dragon Age world.
Right.
So I spoke to David Gaider, who was the person tasked with, think about this now, and it's an incredible responsibility. He was the person tasked with dreaming up the Dragon Age world. Like, go away, please, David, and create this franchise world.
Where do you start with that? I mean, do you start with characters? Do you start with a map? Do you start with just general lore ideas? Like, where do you even begin? That's such a huge undertaking.
Well, appropriately, he began with a map, and he was given specifically a historical atlas of Europe, with which to kind of help conjure the world. He worked with someone called James Olin, who was another key designer on Dragon Age, and he gave David a map, that historical atlas. But he gave this atlas to David because David had, growing up, had been surrounded by like an encyclopedia of, again, of maps, historical maps, because his parents brought him like a collection of maps for the year he was born in 1971.
That's such a lovely idea.
Yeah, as like a stamp in time to be like, this is the year you were born. And so he grew up reading those, and history and maps were kind of two things. He's a massive Crusader Kings player now. He's got like 1300 hours in Crusader Kings 2 and like 800 hours in Crusader Kings 3. So that's to him is the perfect game of like history and maps. So understandably, when he sat down to create Dragon Age, he needed a map. And in fact, he didn't sketch one map, he sketched a series of them, or he drew one and then photocopied it a number of times, and then started basically doing different lines to show like a spread of empires, and basically drew himself an encyclopedia of maps to create the world. And those sketches, actually, he kindly shared and are in the piece that,
that's incredible,
people can see now. The first bit, the first marks of Dragon Age on paper. It's so strange because now, researching this piece, I bought, finally, years later, there is a Dragon Age encyclopedia now. It's called The World of Thedas, and it comes in, there are two books, and they're really gorgeous things, actually, and filled with art and lore and all this kind of stuff. I think they had a world Bible on the writing team when they were making the game, which is just this chunk of lore, which the writers were cool with, but apparently trying to get programmers and artists to read things is a separate challenge, because they see things in a different way. You know, they respond to stuff in a different way. So they've sort of formalized this into an encyclopedia, and of course it's got maps in as well. And it feels
like I've got books behind me that are like Final Fantasy, and I've got a Tolkien encyclopedia somewhere that's got all the maps of the world and stuff in it. Like, I love those kinds of books.
Yeah. So let me ask you, actually, I said I'd test the theory on you earlier. So I was speaking to games industry business, Chris String, earlier in the office, and I mentioned maps, and he instantly told me like what his favorite map was. I think it was Ocarina of Time. He's got it like framed on a wall or something somewhere. But if I said to you, like, video game maps or maps in general, what are the maps that kind of fly into your head almost without thinking?
There's a couple. I mean, I think as a recent example, you've already mentioned Elden Ring, and I think that is a really, really interesting recent example. I think a couple of others that spring to mind for me, one is probably Link's Awakening. And I think that's because that game is literally created with of squares, which collectively give you that map overall. So the map is essentially literally just the world if you zoomed out, but it's already divided up into very neat squares. And I feel like in my head, like even now, I'm like, yep, you start over here and then you work your way around, and I can sort of navigate my way around it in my head just because those squares are so clear. Yeah. And sort of knowing how it's all laid out. I think another one is, and it's barely a map, to be honest, would be Sonic on the Master System.
Ah, interesting.
Because, so Sonic on the Master System came after the original Mega Drive one, and they sort of created this world map that you see in the level screens. So, because otherwise it's just, if you think of Sonic, it's just a series of zones that you go to, and you're never really clear how they connect. But in that game, they have this actual sort of world map, and each zone you sort of move around that map. So it's not a map in the sort of normal sense, but it's the sort of image of what the world is, and you can see each zone as you work around. And for me as a kid, that really helped to give context to the levels that I was playing. You know, it wasn't just these disparate levels of, you know, jungle zone and bridge zone and whatever else. It was like I could see them connecting, and that really inspired me. Like, I loved Sonic as a kid. I sat writing stories about Sonic and Tails,
fan fiction.
Yeah, and like drawing pictures of them all the time. And I think the map in that game really just helped to give context and helped to give a sense of place. And I think that's something that maps can do really well, especially when you look back at those earlier games where they are very level based. Those levels can be very distinct, but a map can really help to bring the world together into one place.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating point, actually, and something that I don't really talk about. Well, I don't talk about in the article, but that was a massive thing. Is a lot of games from those eras didn't, of course, come with maps, although there's some famous examples in Super Mario Brothers, particularly when you started to have the exploration map and it started to link together all those things. That's a really powerful example. But people then, and there's a website that tracks this, I think it's videogamemaps.com or vgmaps.com,
fitting,
something like that. And but it is people, it's the community compiling effectively maps of it might just be a level, but it might be like an entire game, and they're mapping the worlds where the game hasn't done that for them. So it's this, and it speaks to this desire for us to be able to place ourselves in a world, I think, which I think is where an instinctive fundamental desire in mapping our world or another world has come from and will continue to be. I think you can see this wherever, you know, in these funky old biblical maps that people drew, which are like sort of our world, or as much as they knew it, but also sort of interwoven with like the Garden of Eden or like people with no heads, because did they exist? But like that was what was important to people at the time, which is another key thing. Like, maps have always had a use. That's kind of what makes them a map, really. They had to have a use of some kind, and their use was often determined by a sort of agenda or ties into an agenda behind the map. And so there's always one of the big points I sort of land the piece on is that there's always a map shows a perspective. There's always a different perspective behind a map, you know, whether that's a literal perspective, as in like going up in the air to look down. Maps didn't always do that. Or whether it just shows you the perspective of how people understood the world at the time, or, you know, or what they wanted from it. There's always something going on in maps. It's sort of as you can feel the thought behind them, which I think is interesting.
Is there anything in the piece as well around maps in terms of level design? Because I guess if you think of like, how do you, and maybe with Gaeta, you know, creating a world, like, is that based on a loose map of Europe and to make it seem topographically realistic? Or do you sort of just sort of put some splurges down and think, right, okay, how do I link that? Like, how do you literally design the shape of the map?
It's interesting, isn't it? When you go right back to the fundamentals, you're like, what? Where does a world begin? Is the power, the godly power in a pen just hitting the paper and drawing a line? That line suddenly, what? That could be anything. That could be, is that the coastline? Is that a continent? You know, what is that? You're literally drawing, you know, landscapes into a reality of some kind. I was fascinated actually to discover, talking to a bunch of map makers, there's a chap who is the most prominent map maker I could find on TikTok, actually, and is big on Instagram as well. His name there, or the account there, is Dungeon Master's Diary. And he's called Cody. And he draws directly with pen on paper in a sort of deceptively simple way. And it's quite quietly thrilling, because you're like, oh, that's so risky. You're just, you know, what if you make a wrong mark? And I think that's part of the desire. Funnily enough as well, he shared his sort of journey on TikTok. So he kind of started in 2018. He had a little bit of background in sort of draftsmanship, but so he shared that in, so he's kind of gotten better quite notably over time. But when he's drawing, he might start with a mountain, and in his head, what you don't see, and perhaps underneath the paper, is that he is viewing, he has this knowledge, and so do many others actually, of I'm not really sure what you call it, topography, geography, earth science, whatever, but he's thinking underneath the ground, like tectonic and plate levels and all this kind of stuff. So if he puts a mountain there, he's like, well, if it's on its own, it's a volcano. And he's like, well, if it's a volcano, it's got to be on this like a fault line here, because, you know, there's got to be a gap where this comes. So he's like, well, this, that will probably mean that this follows after. And if I've got, you know, if it's a mountain range, then, you know, probably there, you know, there might be some streams and stuff running off this, and maybe it's going to form into a river, and then the river's going to move like this. So it's like a chain reaction of geographic logic that's kind of happening. So even though it looks like he's just putting kind of bits down willy-nilly, he's not. Like, it's all building, and then he just sort of builds this map on kind of composite. It's a composite for all these kind of different things that he's thinking, and many others. I spoke to the lady Devon Rue, who is the critical role mapper, and she was like, the same thing for her. It starts with fault lines and tectonic plates and stuff like that. She's all the stuff you can't see, but which informs an actual proper logical sense of the world. Although they are also quick to sort of acknowledge that you know, they realize they're drawing fantasy worlds. So, you know, you might have something completely, well, literally out of this world on the map as well. And that's okay. But for a lot of them, it's all grounded and rooted in scientific reality. But a lot of them, others start big, start with shapes. So probably continent shapes. The other thing to remember drawing a map is that worlds are massive. And it's something that irks me a little bit in fantasy. I think sometimes I'm thinking of George R. R. Martin's world. So you've got the Westeros continent, then you've got the Essos continent, and then something. like something somewhere. Because I feel people sort of set out, this is why you see so many islands, because islands are like this perfect thing, because you're like, oh, it can just exist somewhere. You can be like, I've made Fiji or something, and it's like, it's fine. I don't need to draw, you know, the rest of the Pacific, you know, or all this stuff around it. I think when people go to lay down a continent, they start, or even just a land, a region, they start to realize like how big these places are, you know, and how much actual detail is in them. It's one of the things. So the Dragon Age, like you talk about the Dragon Age world, similarly to like the Witcher world, it's just, even the Sword Coast kind of Forgotten Realms area, it's not a world, it's barely a continent. It's like a part of it. You know, a lot of people are drawing kind of Europe, but not even, you know, even Europe is big. You know, if you go down to it, if you get up close a bit, you're like, oh, holy shit, this is a lot of detail, actually. Go on, you were going to ask something.
I was going to say, like, and also, do you only want to create a small part of the world so that there's room for it to grow? You know, if it becomes a franchise and you want to explore other worlds in this world, you know, other continents, where do they fit in the map? You know, is this, when you're drawing a map, I guess when we see it, it's a 2D sort of just block of a square, but are you thinking of that as a globe? In which case, is this the complete world or is there more? You know, you mentioned Final Fantasy earlier. I'm pretty sure maybe all of them, if not most of them, when you go up the top, you come back up the bottom and left and right as well. So it gives you that sense
like
that,
Pac-Man.
Yeah. So it gives you that sense that it's a globe, but it's actually just a flat square.
Yeah. Like our world.
Yeah, exactly.
but it's true, right? How many creators really think of, you know, we talk about world maps, but we're not talking about a world map, because, you know, I don't think any of them have come close to being a world. Maybe far from, I'm sure thinking of World of Warcraft, but it had two continents, you know, loosely, I suppose, like America and then Europe, or maybe America and Africa. It was that sort of, then it sort of gained more. But even so, you don't get a sense of it as like a whole thing. I think that's why we talk about technological advancement, actually. There's a couple of things here, but one of them is, I come back to, we talk about function being maybe a little bit cold and sterile, but look at something like Flight Simulator and look at how exciting it is in that game to see all the real world data from something like maps piped in, and suddenly, you know, this immeasurable level of detail that you could, it would take years for creators to kind of, you know, come up with, and suddenly you're flying around the world and look at the power that has over bystanders who come and see, and suddenly like, oh my god, I can fly away on this holiday I once went on. Or if you're my partner, for instance, who lives in quite a large town actually in Bulgaria, but it's not a town that's been mapped in video games before, because it's not London or Paris or New York or, you know, something massive like one of these famous cities, and being able to fly there and go, how are this is that road that I've gotten on a bus on and it's taken me along. That's really exciting kind of use of technology. On the other hand, AI is a scary use of technology, which they are all, you know, unequivocably they don't like. And it's not so much that, there's a few different things to talk about with AI, I think. Like, is it actually AI to start with? But they are all completely against theft, which is effectively what part of it is, you know, at the moment. And it's interesting, they talk about, you know, feeling really vulnerable to this because they're all freelancers, effectively. You know, they're not represented by a union in the same way, you might know about this actually, the same way the music industry is. And it's just, you know, you don't see people's songs being scraped in the same way by AI in the music industry and it being put out, because there's a bit more, it would probably be dangerous, but in a litigation sense. But in, you know, the who's going to stick up for one of these map makers? They're just sort of a little bit just at all these artists who, you know, often are working on their own. So if they're lucky, you know, they're on a team somewhere. But it's, yeah, and frightening. And obviously none of them are up for their stuff being stolen and used without, you know, you. It's like, it's a no-brainer. The other side of it is programs that are out there that let you kind of shortcut the work and, you know, kind of will populate a world for you, that, like tools, effectively. And that's slightly different. But still, I think, I think that what's really nice and what I learned a lot about, a thought that really occurred to me during the writing of this, was that maps, I think, appeal to us and things appeal to us because we can sort of feel the thought behind them. In some cases, we kind of connect to the human thought that's gone into them. There's this wonderful map maker called Mike Schley, who's done loads of D&D stuff. If you've played a D&D campaign in the last 10 years, probably longer, you've seen some of his work. He does very zoomed in things, like some of the sort of encounter maps, you know, even interiors of buildings, and they're top down and accurate, but he also manages to kind of imbue a sort of warmth and personality there as well, that sort of sucks you in. So he kind of manages to occupy a middle ground. And he talks about when he's making maps, you know, he'll work big to small, like others do as well, you know, laying down the big shapes, and then he gets up close for the minutiae, which is his favorite part. And he talks about almost discovering a map, like he's walking around in it in his mind's eye, and like trampling the grass between a building and kind of seeing these details. And I think that's the special thing that I feel like, it might be a romantic view, but I feel like that's the stuff that really speaks to us. And coincidentally, the stuff that is probably missing from an AI piece, because there's no creative thought involved. There's no...
Yeah, yeah.
I talked to a guy called Constantis Demopoulos, who he doesn't feature anywhere in the piece, actually, because it's like a whole separate thought. He is an urban, city kind of designer, and he helps people design cities in games. And we had some fascinating conversations about that kind of thing. But he talked about the feeling of walking around a city and maybe sitting in a public space or you know, visiting some of the architects, the impressive architecture, and just relishing the kind of thought that's gone into it. Like, someone's designed that especially for you to enjoy, you know, to be enjoyed by humans. And I think that's a real palpable feeling that you can get in the real world. And I think that you can also relate to in maps. And I also found it fascinating. My partner was using, or we were tinkering around with this tool, this map making tool called Canvas of Kings, which is really pretty. It makes these like very parchmenty kind of maps. And she said this wonderful thing. She was laying down some stuff and making a little forested area. And then she was putting some birds down in the map. And all of a sudden she said, she's like, oh, I'm putting them there because I think something scared them. And I loved this remark, because I was like, it's instinctive. She couldn't help but give the map a story and make give something a storied justification, because what she was doing. And I think it's the same, you know, for any of us when we do something like that.
This sounds like a really, really fascinating topic. And one of those topics
really boring that's... now when you read
No. But it's also one of those things where you have a tiny thought and then it suddenly you realize how much work goes into something like creating a map and how much depth there is to it. And then you're like, how do I put this in a piece? Because there's just so much to it.
Which is sort of something that I end up kind of realizing in the piece, which is that there's no central one answer. Well, there sort of is. I do come away with like a takeaway, which is perspectives. You know, maps show us perspectives that and someone's perspective is as much, like we said earlier, as much about them and their view on the world And I think inherently we find that interesting, how people, other people see things and other people view things. But you're right, this was a piece that other pieces I think that I've done have typically maybe told the story of one person, or maybe I've had a few different speakers in the piece, but I've never had 10 different speakers, maybe 11 if you count the British Library duo. It was two people at once. And so I was sort of exploring the topic as I was kind of researching and interviewing it. So when I started, I didn't know where I would end. It wasn't like I was meeting someone just saying, I want to tell your story, which is easy. You know, you just follow the story of someone's life in a sense and maybe veer off here and there a little bit. So I was trying to find this, and yeah, it took a lot of work to do. I mean, just so people have an idea of the work, so there were 10 different people to speak to, which involves preparation for each of those interviews, you know, which is working out what you want to talk to them about, what you want to ask them about, and also arranging them in the first place, which can take a bit of to and fro.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And then there's the time, you know, talking to them. I talk to them all for roughly an hour, sometimes a bit more, sometimes less. And then once you've got that recording, it then needs transcribing in varying sort of levels of detail. But I like to have it in, I like to have it as, you know, usable as possible. I don't want to go back and sort of do stuff afterwards. So there's that. And then there's the working out what you want the piece to be and the actual kind of writing of it. I don't know where. So I think I was writing this for about almost 2 solid weeks, I think, which is it's an incredible luxury. And a big shout out to Christian Donlan and the rest of the, you know, the sort of Eurogamer editorial kind of higher ups, as it were, for pushing this as a sort of focus on the site, and for allowing people that kind of time, because it is, is a luxury.
It's very time consuming.
Yeah.
Very. I think it took me similarly like 2 or 3 weeks to do it. And then it's like, oh, well, now there's edits. So now I need to go back to it again. And you sort of think you're done with it. And you're like, oh, no, there's still more to do. So, yeah, it is very time consuming. But you need that time and space to, as you say, to sort of get your thoughts down, because there are so many things that you're thinking, that's interesting, and how do you condense that into something that is actually readable for people?
So you did you were looking at character creators, and I think through the lens of sort of diversity. Mm-hmm. So did what your, and I know that there were some edits that happened. I don't know if it was rewritten or anything like that. I mean, did the piece change from what you sort of initially thought it was, even in the writing? Like how much changed?
There was a fairly big edit, which I think comes back to that point I was just saying of there's so much that you want to put in. I think I wrote about 11,000 words the first time and was like, this 9, needs to be chopped 000. In half. And it's like, you're so excited to put everything in, you're like, no, I need to find the story in this. Yeah. And sort of find that thread that takes people through it. So yeah, it's time consuming, but I think it all comes down to having a sort of central question that you want to ask and trying to find the answer to that, and also allowing yourself to be surprised by that answer. Because for me, I sort of had this idea of what does the ultimate character creator look like, which is an incredibly broad and massive, massive question, because we're nowhere close to that yet. And my thinking was, okay, well, what diversity and representation questions are in that? What technical advancements do we need to create this tool that can do everything that you want? And I sort of realized that actually that's not what it's about at all, which was a nice surprise to get to that point. But I realized that a character creator is a sort of gateway between the player and the player being able to represent themselves, but also how the player interacts with the world. And so the character creator has to serve the world that it's linked to as much as it does the player. So, you know, something like Cyberpunk is going to have sort of cybernetics and things that you can fuse to your character, which is not something you're going to find in Baldur's Gate, for instance. So there are going to be specific things that allow you to interact with that world. Or again, with Cyberpunk, it's like you're not just creating any old character. It's you are creating V, and there is a specific story that V is involved with. So what is your interpretation of who V is? Are you playing as you or as yourself?
You can see why some games opt for the pre-written character.
Yeah, exactly, because it's just sometimes easier, I guess, to have that specific narrative. So it's that real balance between like player expression and the narrative of the world. And once that clicked for me, I realized, okay, this piece is not quite what I thought it was going to be when I first started.
There's an amount of bravery as well and kind of nerve in that, because the piece is, there's a point when I find when you're faced with, you know, you go out and you gather lots of information. I was reading this wonderful book at the same time called The Writer's Map. I think that's what it's called. And it's filled with various authors and other people, some explorers and people like that, talking about maps and often used in their process and how, you know, how they came across it. And it's filled with wonderful, loads more wonderful comments and things. But just, you know, I'd already had all these wonderful comments. And at one point you sort of there and imagine like one of those like diagrams around your head or one of those things and showing all this information, and you're kind of standing in the middle of it, like, how am I gonna pull all this into one piece? And it's not, you know, one of the transcriptions could easily be 10,000 words, and you're like, well, how am I gonna fit this in? It's been an interesting challenge for sure.
You have to be ruthless.
Yes. It's interesting what you said about character creators actually being a sort of portal into their world, because people talked about maps being like that as well.
Yeah,
as
exactly.
A kind of, you know, a character creator is more than a tool. It's a way of sort of underlining the fantasy of the world before you begin on it, like take Baldur's Gate one for instance. You know, it's often the first thing you encounter in a game, so it needs to you obviously want yourself, well, or you want your character, your game's identity to, you know, to see you and represent you in as whichever ways, you know, you want it to do that. But at the same time, it needs to kind of pull you into the fantasy as well, you know, which is super exciting as well.
I don't know what the next one is, but are we going to find that that's also a portal? And then maybe like this whole series is just like portals, is like portals. The name of it. Portals into games.
So given all of that transcription and stuff that inevitably doesn't fit, and that you have to kind of filter to get the bits, you know, that support the thread that you're making through your piece. Are you now left with a pile of things that you haven't used and that you want to use?
I don't know how much of it would be usable. It's probably like little snippets of things that you're like, oh, that was a really interesting point, but it just didn't quite fit the argument that was needed. So there's probably, I mean, I can't think off the top of my head, but there are probably lots and lots of little bits from each interview. You know, there were some interviews that I was only able to use a couple of quotes from, and the rest of the stuff was interesting, but often you get multiple people making very, very similar points. And that's the point where you have to be ruthless of like, well, who said it in the most interesting way or the most succinct way that makes for a nice quote? And everybody else, I'm really sorry, you made great points, but I just don't have the space. So yeah, there's probably lots of little offcuts. I don't think there's anything that on its own would necessarily stand up. I mean, there were entire sections of my piece I thought that could be a piece in itself. And do I put it in? Do I not? And I wanted to keep it as... I wanted to keep everything in as much as I could, but yeah, I'm sure there are various offcuts, and I'm sure you've got tons of stuff from yours as well.
Yeah, I mean, notably, there was a wonderful bit. I was talking to David Gader, and I think he has said this before, but I'm not sure in how much detail, but he talked about how he wanted to kill. There's a character called Varric in Dragon Age, which people will be super familiar
with. He's the dwarf, right?
Yeah. Yes. And became a mate. And he desperately wanted to kill Varric off at the end of Dragon Age 2. And because he's like, he was the unreliable narrator of the game at the beginning. And he was like, it needed to end with his death. And it didn't for some reason. And then he was going to do it in an expansion for Dragon Age 2. But the expansion got canned because he then wanted to, they wanted to use that time to work on Inquisition, Dragon Age 3. And then he was desperate to do it in 3. And they're just like, chill out. Just stop trying to kill this character.
Why do you hate Varric?
But he was, yeah, I don't think he hates. But it's interesting now because Varric's probably going to pop up in, okay, I'm trying to think what happened to him in the Inquisition. I think he's still alive.
I think so, yeah.
But, you know, he might now pop up in Dragon Age 4. And that was another point which was interesting talking to David Gaider about. So he left BioWare a while ago now. I can't remember the exact year. 2017 or so. Like, it was, he's been away for like a number of years, maybe 2016. And he had nothing to do with Dragon Age 4. It hasn't touched it at all. So now he is awaiting Dragon Age 4 like the rest of us. And yet, it's not quite like the rest of us because he created the world and he created so many of these characters.
That must be the weirdest feeling. Like, I created this and now someone else is completely in charge of that.
And it was happening over the time that he was there. You know, he would say, you know, with every game, with every imagining of the world, it got firmer and firmer, you know, more tangible. And more, well, I mean, you could literally touch it in the game. You could stand in it and walk around in it. And people would join the team who had played it and knew these worlds, knew these characters, you know, that had once come from his head. And his, you know, his team then would collectively fill out the history because, you know, he's like, I'm just one guy, you know. He sort of made a start and then it got filled in. But now, yeah, what an odd feeling. He's not sure if he can play the game. Like, he's not sure if he'll be able to, because he's like, what if, you know, they're going to Tevinter in the game, which is where Dorian comes from. And Dorian is this like hugely important character to David Gaider. He created him, you know, he's the first, I think, specifically gay character in the series. There was, there's lots of reasons. He was a wonderful character as well. And he's like, what if Dorian's in it? You know, what does he do then? And he behaves in a certain way. He's like, I created him. That's like my, you know, he's like my guy. And you're using him in a different way. So, yeah, that's a fascinating thing. But then, you know, if you were to look at Tolkien, and were Tolkien alive now, you know, what would he think about Peter Jackson's films?
Yeah.
What would he think about the Amazon series? You know. But you have living examples of this too. You have George R. R. Martin in the Game of Thrones series that he created and sort of handed over. You have Andrzej Sapkowski and the Witcher series, which has obviously been taken into games famously and also onto a Netflix series. And these kind of things that it's this odd sort of paradox, but by their own definition, they want the success for these worlds. But in having the success, they sort of have to hand them over to other creatives to kind of, so they, in the same way David did, you know, slightly different thing, but had to hand it over, you know, it was always going to be made by a bigger team. And it's interesting with these other creations as well. There's always an element of that. And also with the communities that play them. One of the things that really struck me in the fantasy exhibition was how they had a section for fan fiction, which is a hugely important sort of collective underlining of these worlds and often fills in, as the people at the British Library were saying, some of the really important blanks in terms of representation, you know, inclusion, things that are lacking in these fictions, maybe initially. People put themselves into them in that way. And that, in a sense, is also sort of handing over to other people. So it's fascinating. And it's made me more fascinated in maps, I think, than less.
Well, that's good that you're not sick of it.
Yeah. I think it's amazing how variable the appeal of a map is as well, just depending on who we are and our experience with that world or that thing. You know, it could be the most, it could be a really dreary, ugly map, but because it means something to you and your life, it could be a really important important thing. And it's the same is true of games as well. You know, it will only take sometimes just to look at that Zelda A Link to the Past map or something, and people are like, oh my god, it's my childhood. So yeah, it's interesting. So are you keen to write another of these pieces anytime soon, Ed?
Is that a request or an offer? No, you're on the spot. If there's a topic that warrants it, absolutely. I think there are so many interesting topics that warrant this kind of in-depth analysis and study. So yeah, of course. I think it's always good to be curious and to have questions. And it's also great to speak to the people that make these games and for us to understand more about the actual work that goes into them and the sort of creative starting points for them.
That was a great answer. To everyone... To everyone listening, thanks for bearing with us as we talk through this. I hope you enjoy the maps piece I've written. If you haven't read Ed's piece on character creators, it will be linked from my piece as well. So please go and read that as well. And let us know what you think as well. You know, come and comment on the article and tell us about a map that's special to you or a character creator that you love. You know, we'd love to hear from you, and I'll be chit-chatting in the comments as I always do instead of doing actual work. Thank you, Ed, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm Bertie, that was Ed, and we will be back soon in Some Guys on another podcast. Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye.